Would you take $20 million, Brooke, except every time you laugh from now on, you laugh exactly like a donkey, as loud as a donkey?
I'm totally fine. Totally fine.
That's funny.
And then they're like, oh my God, she is so rich. She just has this weird laugh.
Yeah, but look at her jewelry. Look at her clothes.
Oh my God, she's been on an amazing.
Who's the donkey now?
Look at all our homes.
Welcome to Under Embargo, the podcast that says the quiet part out loud about PR, communications, and the chaos in between. Hosted by two of LinkedIn's most connected comms pros, Becca Chambers, a no BS corporate comms exec with raging ADHD, and Parry Hedrick, founder of tech PR firm Crackle PR. This show brings it all. Real talk, sharp insights, and the kind of industry truths they don't put in press releases. No fluff, no filters, no f**ks given. This is Under Embargo. Let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the Under Embargo podcast. I am your host, Becca Chambers, CMO of Scale Venture Partners, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Parry Hedrick, founder of Crackle PR.
Hello.
Today, we are welcoming somebody who I think many of you listening probably know because she is one of the most prolific communications recruiters out there. For the past 20 years, Brooke has been recruiting PR and comms professionals for tech companies, for startups, for PR agencies, pretty much anywhere the comms person is, Brooke is there. And I am happy to say that she's even working with me right now to help me find the perfect person to join my team. So I'm really excited to bring Brooke to the show today. Welcome, Brooke Kruger, founder of KC Partners.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so I'm going to kick off with just the most obvious question that I know is on every single person's mind who's listening. And how is the job, comms job market these days? And is it getting better?
Great question. So the good news, it is getting better. We've been in a kind of standstill since probably the summer, fall of 2022 after the big boom during the COVID years. And it has been really steady since, I would say, for about a year. It's been steady hiring. And right now we're seeing more and more positions opening up. We're seeing more candidates leave jobs and take new jobs, which means their positions will open up. And then we're also seeing an opportunity for a lot of people to consult right now because there's a lot of business to go around.
So why are things going so well? Explain.
We don't want to be like over eager, but going well, I think is a good way to put it. I think that for so long, these positions, you know, for the past 2 years have been on hold. And finally, you know, teams have been told to do more with less, and headcount will, you know, be around the corner, and it's finally around the corner. So companies are feeling more confident to open up headcount, and candidates are feeling more confident to take risk and leave their current roles. For a while, people didn't even want to leave their current role because, you know, they could have been miserable in the known, but the unknown was even trickier.
Though I have heard about this like job hugging phenomenon people are talking about now, which is the opposite of quiet quitting, which is just hanging on to a shitty job, doing whatever you need to do to like make sure you don't get laid off in the current situation, I guess, because of all of the insecurity. But you're saying
that is happening too. There are candidates who are like, you know what? I've been here for a while. I have good benefits. I have good equity. I'm not happy at all, but making a change is just too disruptive right now for my life.
I think there is a contributing factor to the robustness, if we can use that word, for the comms market. And that is the bouquet that has been thrown at PR and communications via AI. And by that, I mean the importance of earned media in delivering answers on LLMs like ChatGPT. I just wrote today, I was quoting the guy from Gregory Gallant of Muckrack, the CEO. He put out a study that said more than 89% of links cited from AI come from earned media, according to this big report they put out. That's an incredible statistic and incredibly beneficial for those of us in PR
and recent earned media at that, yeah. Perry. So what you earned, yeah, a year ago is not what's ranking you in the LLMs. I just wanted to clarify, because to your point, yeah, that makes timely communications ever more important.
It's ongoing. So are you hearing or seeing anything along those lines, Brooke, when you look at the comms market writ large?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, there are, AI is going to take away some jobs in communications because of, if I think of what I did when I started on the PR agency side, AI would be so helpful in writing and tracking coverage and things like that. But then people using AI to their benefit is also happening. And then earned media has never been more important. However, the shrinking pool of journalists makes it, and publications, makes it so much harder to get that earned media. So I don't know if you guys feel this way, but when I see, you know, my candidates and clients and I see these like major placements, I'm like so proud for them, because I think like how hard that must have been to get that story in today's climate.
Yeah, there is no doubt that there is a vanishing number of the marquee sort of publications that we've all come to love. And most of the people that we are supposed to build relationships with have been fired, laid off, switched papers, switched, you know, publications over and over and over again. So PR teams literally have to reinvent relationships over and over and over. And against that backdrop, there's a whole new swath of different outlets and mediums that we have to be proficient, if not excellent in now, including podcasts and Substack like Beehive and all this kind of stuff. So I would argue that there's probably more people publishing right now than ever before, but it's just so atomized and little tiny pockets across the ecosystem. So it makes it a lot more work, and a lot more challenging to infiltrate all of these places.
Well, and it's a different muscle, right? Like we all have to adapt as the media landscape is adapting. And to your point, atomizing all over, we all have to learn how we then pitch those stories to those people. Is it one-to-one? Is it they're finding you through your thought leadership on social media, which is definitely a thing now, right? Like, yeah, is it podcast publicity? Like, I don't know what the answer is, but I know that it's changing. And I know that it's probably making what is valuable in communications professionals different. So actually, that is a question for Brooke. Two questions. Are hiring managers changing what they're looking for in general as far as specific skills? And then are the employees or the comms leaders that you're talking to, are they kind of targeting different types of roles as things are changing?
So to answer the first question, yes, things are changing. The skill set is changing. It's getting bigger. If you have news, it's now how many, you know, different ways can we skin a cat? How many different ways can we get this out there? You know, are we going to try to get earned media? Are we going to do thought leadership? Are we going to do a podcast? Are we going to do a video? How are we going to get that? So I think as a communications professional, you need to be able to always up in your skills in your game, and you need to be a good storyteller and know how to tell that story and where it's going to resonate. Hiring managers are also a couple trends, or you know what I'm seeing in new searches I'm doing: creativity, curiosity, storytelling. You know, storytelling's always been there, but you need to be more creative telling it. And then the second part of your question was, will you repeat that?
The candidates themselves.
Yeah, are they changing the way that they are either what they're targeting or how they're presenting themselves given the changing?
So I think, yes, I think it's always good to be evolving and changing. I think when I left PR, it was 2005 and there were no blogs really to pitch. So like my skill set in 2005 is completely different than the comms person of today. So I think candidates, yes, they need to always be upping their game and be interested. And again, I mean, it goes back to simple things: storytelling, creativity, curiosity. One thing I hear from hiring managers frequently now is like, I don't want someone with the same playbook that thinks it's going to work for every single company they've been to. And so, which is, I mean, so honest and simple. Yes.
I'm like, so relieved to hear that, because it used to be the opposite, where like you went in and they would be like, so how have you done X, Y, and Z? And it's like, well, this is how I've done it, but that doesn't really apply to your scenario. It needs to be totally different, because you can't just rinse and repeat if you go somewhere else. So I actually think that's refreshing to hear that hiring managers are looking for somebody who can think outside of the playbook.
Yes, I do too. But the other thing, those questions are still important in the interview process, because the other thing of hiring managers want to know, like, what happened when the problem happened, were you the call? And what did you do to answer it? And so also thinking quick on your feet and being able to, you always have to be good at strategy, but there is no room now for not executing. A comms leader needs to be able to pick up the phone and execute.
So a couple of things about this. This is fascinating. So I would have thought you would have said, when it comes to what the hiring managers are looking for and what the candidates themselves are presenting, is AI, a big piece of AI. So like, we're looking for AI proficient people that know how to streamline workflows and how to make shorter work of, you know, all these redundant, repetitive tasks. That would be one thing, because everybody's looking to cut headcount and maximize revenue per employee on the hiring side. And then from the job candidate standpoint, everybody I know just about is trying to, puff out their chests a little bit on the AI front, saying like, hey, I put the work in, I put the time in. Yes, we're all learning, but I'm really trying actively to do X, Y, and Z to make myself look marketable for the future, to future-proof myself. You're not seeing the AI piece being bandied about?
I have a different outlook on that. I mean, okay, if you are not using AI to improve your job right now, like, that is, I mean, that's a mistake. But you know, it's like saying, you know, Excel. You know, you need to know ChatGPT. You need to know Excel. That is it is moving so quickly that the playing field has completely changed. Everyone should be using AI in their job, in their daily life, you know, to do better. So I think,
is what you're saying.
It's table stakes, but candidates who can market themselves as being even a more proven expert, yes, but I think it's expected that you know how to use AI and you're constantly trying to improve efficiency in your work and the work around you.
I thought on the hiring side, it would be even more pronounced, just because everybody's trying to get more efficient, do more with fewer people. I thought that would be a big ask. And you're not seeing that, it sounds like.
I think it's just expected.
Huh. Okay.
That is interesting, actually, especially because I don't think most of the people that I work with and in my like professional networks are using AI, but I don't think everybody's using it in their everyday job. You know, like, I don't think it's
not yet.
No, I know. But that's why I'm like Perry, I'm surprised if it's not like one of the top questions that hiring managers are asking of people is like, how are you applying AI to your job? And how is it making it better? Because even if it's just like, you know, I use ChatGPT for research or whatever, like, at least you're like showing that you're moving in that direction.
I mean, that's a fair question, but I just go back to being, it's so expected. At my son's high school, back to school night for Spanish, the Spanish teacher said, we're never grading homework or doing tests at home. Everything graded will be in class, because otherwise you would just use AI. So they are fully expecting everybody to be using AI for things. And I felt like that was a very interesting statement, because it's just expected.
Super interesting.
When you see candidates come in that aren't talking about AI as part of their sort of package they put forth, do you counsel them to include something like that? Or again, it just sounds like to you, this is expected.
I would counsel everyone to say, yes, this needs to be a part of your daily work. And then I also, if you do have the creative ways you're using AI, I think that would be something to elaborate. But if you're using AI to edit your work, I mean, you still, you know, that's not, I think, a selling point. I think everyone should be using that.
Yeah, I'm thinking more like share of voice and like share of voice on LLMs and like all the sort
I mean, that again, that stuff, absolutely. And if you can market yourself in that, but I also think it's we're turning where it's expected.
Can I ask one more thing about the skill sets? Can you break down kind of what the universe of candidates you deal with is? Like, what's comms? What's the percentage of like PR? Like, how does it, what's the mix?
Okay. For me. So I place, you know, top comms talent. We work with agencies, corporations, startups, and VC firms. Most of our positions are pre-post IPO high growth companies, whether that's the head of comms, chief comms officer, head of corporate communications, and then the positions that layer up into those roles. So for example, I worked with the Instacart CCO and we placed 30 people on their comms team to build that out during up into COVID. But I also do kind of one-off positions where it's like I had a comms at an early stage company. And then I also work with venture firms like Becca at Scale Ventures to find them a comms hire as well. And I still work with corporations as well to build out their comms team. But the most of my candidate level are mid to senior level.
Got it. And so I have been arguing for a long while, and Becca knows this. She reads my constant ranting on LinkedIn. I think that most organizations, especially B2B organizations, once they get over a certain threshold of revenue, whether it's 10 million or 15 million, whatever it is, once you get to a certain point, I think it's incumbent upon those companies to have some kind of a chief communications officer title. For sure. Just like that's it. And a lot of companies are still resistant to that, relying too heavily on marketing, in my estimation. So I'm guess what I'm just looking for you to say is, what are you seeing? Are you seeing more of a trend toward people embracing what I'm talking about and advocating for? Or do you still see companies actively pushing back and trying to throw everything under the marketing bucket?
I see both. I do think communications has a seat at the table now more than ever. And I think most companies are doing a full communications track that reports into the C-suite or C-level CEO. Then there are companies that still have the comms position under marketing. Now, we're not talking about venture. We're talking about corporations or, you know, earlier stage companies pre-post IPO. But many are having comms be a separate loop, and that is recognized, and that's what candidates essentially want. However, I have placed many candidates under a great CMO, and it works out. So I would say it just depends on who the marketing organization is, who's running it, and if comms is valued there as well.
I feel like the value that communications brings has always been extreme, but now that it's becoming more fragmented and we just have to be in more places, I do think it continues to make less sense to have comms report into marketing. I say that as head of marketing, but that's because in venture, like, we are not running demand gen programs, right? Yes. We are brand, content, PR events, right? It is that stuff that I would argue, let's call it corporate marketing, should be a separate wing, because they are not trying to drive in quarter revenue, right? They are storytelling, they are changing perceptions, they are finding where we need to be and making sure we are in those places. And if those people are reporting to head of marketing who has, you know, revenue quota or MQL quotas, then what? Like, how does the comms person do their job if their goals have nothing to do with the goals of the organization that they serve? So I'm happy to hear that you are seeing the comms loop starting to become its own thing, but I am still sad about the state of communications rolling into marketing myself.
I agree with everything you're saying, and I do, you know, more and more comms is reporting it to the CEO. I had a conversation with a Series E company yesterday afternoon, and they're looking for a head of comms, and they're like, well, then it's going to report. We think it's going to report in the marketing, the head of marketing who reports to the COO, who reports to the CEO. And I said, I don't think that is a good sell, you know, that the three lines away from the CEO, it doesn't make sense. And nope.
Well, you can't do your job. Like, you just can't. Like, you cannot have the access that you need, the understanding, the nuance, everything, if you are a senior level communications leader who is expected to do the things a senior level communications leader is.
And in my mind, I was just thinking, okay, there's a crisis. So then they call the CMO, then the CMO calls the CEO, then the CEO. It's like a game of telephone, right?
It gets sillier when you look at the longevity math. So the average tenure for a CMO is 18 months.
I know.
18 months. Like, by the time you learn the actual company inside and out, you're already like at 6 months. And then you get, you know, maybe another year if you're lucky, according to the averages. And I think that, I don't know what the number is for the head of comms or whatever, but I would argue that it's probably a lot longer than that.
I think so, for sure. And there are amazing CMOs, people I've placed candidates as head of comms at, you know, Series C, D, E companies are reporting to the CMO, and it works out. It really does depend upon the person and how the CMO values communications and if they will let the head of comms stay in their own lane. So there's always exceptions, but the preferred method for me, from candidates, from companies, is this: the comms is a separate track.
Yeah. And if it reports into marketing, that's fine. As to your point, the marketing leader has to understand what comms is and what comms is not, and let the comms leader do their job. Like, don't be like, I'm the head of marketing, so I'm going to tell comms leader how to do their job. It's like, what, you're focused on, you know, demand gen. Like, I just like, 100%.
I've had a couple candidates. A trend I've heard in the last couple of weeks is, because I do a lot of these head of comms jobs with early stage companies, and they're like, I don't want to spend my day having to educate somebody what comms actually does. I want to be able to do the actual comms work. Yeah. And I can put up with a lot, because as you guys probably know, we're kind of in this big boss era of, you know, not a lot of culture. Have you guys heard of the 996?
Yeah.
You know, where people are.
It's back.
You know, it's back.
You can tell our audience what 996 is in case they are unaware.
996 is the principle that you would work 9 to 9, 6 days a week. And when I do new business screens, I actually ask my potential clients if they operate in that model. And, it, you know, the answer hopefully is no, we don't. We work really hard, but we don't do that. So, because that's not an attractive thing to candidates right now.
Yeah.
We go with 997 around here.
Yeah. No breaks, no lunch. One thing that I've been seeing, noticing, whatever, is a proliferation of chief of staff roles that sound an awful lot like a communications leader, right? Without the kind of PR element. Like, it's not that they don't have that, it's just that it's not the focus, but they are this right hand to the CEO, to the point that they are able to act as a strategic advisor, but then also be kind of the person who is telling them like what they need to say, where they need to say it. And I'm not saying that chief of staff should run a comms organization. I'm more thinking, should comms leaders be looking at chief of staff roles if they want to go to the C-suite and not have to deal with this whole marketing comms?
Well, yeah, whatever. And what's the pay differential? I'm curious about that. That's interesting.
That is a good question. I think that there are some excellent chief of staffs, and I've worked with two of them, and they were my contacts almost served as a hiring manager, you know, kind of protecting their CEO. You're running the process and pulling the CEO in, and they were great, and they will work in parallel with the head of comms. And I think I'm thinking of two in my mind who were amazing. And that the head of comms I placed there are so lucky that they get to work in parallel. But there are other chief of staffs, I'm sure, that are, you know, just it's you know, butting heads or.
Exactly. I mean, because
messages and, you know, I have been told, I've never placed a chief of staff, but I've been told it's like the McKinsey Bain model. You know, you're a consultant and you become a chief of staff, which could work and it could.
Unless, but what if you're the CEO who is a modern CEO who now sees, I need to build my brand online, right? While I need to manage my internal brand and messaging and whatever, your chief of staff is who you're going to rely on for that. You're not going to go two levels down to your comms person to say, hey, do this thing, when you have the person who's already right there. I feel like you could, I don't know. I just think that there is this kind of, it's not just operational, right? It's like so much more than operational that I just think that it's a strong next step for a lot of communications leaders. And I continue to tell, when I read the job descriptions, I'm like, this does not sound like the chief of staff from 10 years ago. Like, this sounds.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so at all. And I also think, like, I mean, I love a pivot, like a strong comms person pivoting to a chief of staff role based on your comment before would be great. I don't know the discrepancy or the differences in pay, but I don't think that's a bad pivot if you're looking, you know, to take a little break from the stressful comms world. Not that the chief of staff would be less stressful, but.
Pay is a great topic to pivot because I wanted to ask you, like, I think that the comms pay pendulum swung very high and has swung way back. Mm-hmm. And now maybe there's a correction. What are you seeing as far as like where comms salaries are landing these days?
So I am seeing a correction in the market. They were very high and they swung way low and now they're coming back. There's most companies, and let's talk about, you know, non-agency roles. Most companies offer base plus equity. Bonuses have gone away. There are still some companies that do offer bonuses. Some companies almost, you know, you could also like play with the comp. So you can have, you know, keep the base salary down and then add a bonus that's all but guaranteed. But most salaries right now are starting to shift back. Now, there are, you know, for Series C, D, E companies I deal with, you know, there's set ranges. There's not much flexibility. So for people, you know, some people will have to take a pay cut to take those jobs, but they will hopefully pick that up in equity. Wow. And then some people are at bigger companies that have, you know, more perks and more bonus plan, and they're, you know, they can stay up with the golden handcuffs.
Are the big company salaries going down, or are they kind of remaining what they have been the past
few
years?
They're kind of remaining what they have. I think their bonuses may have been lower for a while.
Because I know that in like smaller tech companies, it was almost like it wasn't just that salaries got lower, they just got rid of the senior leadership so that like everybody had a lower salary because they just got rid of the higher paid people, which is what I saw for the past couple of years, but kind of seems like we're starting to see senior leadership hired again. Are those senior leaders being hired at rates that you think would have been comparable 3 years ago?
I think it would have been rates that would be I look like kind of before COVID, because that was the boom. So I think the rates would have been comfortable before COVID. I think there was a lot of salary inflation during those, you know, busy years to try to land people and build teams.
And comms is still the least paid function in marketing. Do we agree with that? I think that's probably true.
I mean, it could be. It depends on the organization.
Do we agree it should be that way? Hell no. Do we agree?
We can agree that it should not be that way.
Yes.
And not I
don't like to make those, you know, those big blanket statements, because there's always exceptions in different companies.
Yeah. And analyst relations pays a ton compared to many marketing roles, and that usually falls within the communications bucket. But I still see social media being paid like pennies on the dollar, when it's like, this is the most important channel for a lot of you. And you're like, let's just get the intern, right?
With that strategy, because, you know, your social media positions tend to hire younger because they've kind of grown up in the social media era versus us dinosaurs.
I guess, but now the like younger social people, that they're 35. Like they're not real salaries too.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you something on that. Of course, I forgot what I was going to say.
Social media brings up a LinkedIn topic for me. So, you know, Becca and I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. I know you probably do for your job, but in a different way. Like,
yes.
You use it for a much more of a utilitarian function and less of a personal branding function. But to what extent have you seen, or do you see, candidates who are in the comms world using LinkedIn to sort of improve their own stock on the marketplace, essentially? Are you seeing any premium attached to people who are doing a great job on that platform in particular, or other platforms generally?
So I love LinkedIn. I think everybody should be on LinkedIn. I think everyone's job seeking or not, their LinkedIn needs to be up to date. It needs to be tracked. You always want to have a resume ready and a LinkedIn that tracks to that. I think there are certain people who are going to be more comfortable posting on LinkedIn, thought leadership, including the three of us. And there's going to be other people who that's just not their thing. And I totally respect that. How they could stay active on LinkedIn would be to comment and to like post and just be an active user. I also always advise people to constantly be tweaking their LinkedIn, tweaking their bio, tweaking their words. You know, it's a way to present yourself. You know, make sure you have a good headshot. If you don't want to hire a professional photographer, you could send some pictures to AI for $20 and get one. Make sure you have a good banner behind your LinkedIn profile. And I think, you know, having all that stuff and being active on LinkedIn will have you present well. But I do think if you are interviewing in a job, you should expect the hiring manager to be going through your LinkedIn. So whatever you are putting out there represents you. And, you know, if it looks like you've been asleep for, you know, 5 or 6 years, I don't think that's a good look either.
When you talk about tweaking your profile, do you mean, is it important algorithmically? In other words, if you're tweaking your profile?
Yes, it's important algorithmically. In my data, from my mind, I have lots of times when I reach out to a candidate and they say, that's so interesting, I just updated my LinkedIn, which means you appeared in a search for me. So I always recommend people do that.
That's a really good point.
My data that I collect from 20 years of reaching out to comms candidates, but I do, you know, you want to be active on LinkedIn.
That's like, similarly, when you post and comment, you are telling LinkedIn, hi, I'm here, I'm awake. And so it shows, yes. I think like when I don't comment a lot, but I'll go and post, my reach is totally impacted because I really do think it's like priming the pump, right? You're telling LinkedIn, hey, I'm here. Yeah. Like, pay attention to me, I'm active. So if you make those tweaks to your profile, it's telling the recruiters, this person wants to be hired, right? Because they are actively changing it. What's the downside? Like, even if you just went and like rearranged the way that you're.
I never thought about tweaking your profile as a way to wake up the algorithm. That's never entered my mind, and largely because I'm secure in my profession. Yeah. I don't really have to get a job, but what great advice for someone who's considering making a switch or even just passively looking.
100%. But I do want to say, like, some people are not comfortable doing thought leadership, and that is fine. You know, self-promotion, you know, that's fine if you don't want to do that, but you can still be active on LinkedIn. And
I was just going to say, this is just my data. And obviously it's skewed differently than other people's because I do brand building on LinkedIn. But if you go look at how I'm discovered on LinkedIn, less than 1% is through search. So less, like, if people are looking for a communications leader or whatever, less than 1% of the people who find me are doing it through a search bar. People are finding me, it's like 30% through comments. So me commenting and other people, that's how they are ending up landing on my profile. And then obviously my posting and then other people sharing my posts and whatever, which is really like, okay, take the posting out of it. 30% of my views come from just comments, people seeing my comments. Yeah. So to your point, you don't want to be a thought leader. Fine. You do have a perspective. Go start commenting on people's posts because you will be more discoverable. If you're looking for a job, that will like help people land on your profile. And they'll be like, not only do I see what their professional experience is, I also can get a sense of who they are because I can read what their voice sounds like in their comments or what their perspective is, or if they have a good idea and blah, blah, blah. So I'm with you. I think even if you don't want to post on LinkedIn, go just start commenting because you will be way more discoverable. And if you're looking for opportunities, whether it's a job or something else, like show
up. And for all those people listening to this podcast right now, it's critically important that you spend most of your time commenting on my post and Becca's post. That's obviously how you really juice the algorithm.
That is the secret to success.
Yes.
It is 100%.
Yeah. So yeah, no, I'm a huge fan of LinkedIn. I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. I think it's a great tool. I was an early user and I would encourage everyone to, you know, constantly update, tweak their LinkedIn.
I actually pitched Reid Hoffman in the very earliest, like I think maybe the first year or second year of LinkedIn's existence, pitched him twice with my then team at Shift Communications in San Francisco. So I was super, super early on and I just did not get what the power or what the vision was of LinkedIn. We didn't win. We came in second place twice and I deserved to come in second place because I really, it was a glorified Rolodex to me and I couldn't see the larger plan. And boy has that changed. And now I'm probably one of the biggest evangelists on the planet for this thing.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I mean, it was a Rolodex for a long time. Like that is what it was boring as hell.
Do you remember you used to go to restaurants? My friend who was in sales said he would go to like restaurants and they'd have like a fishbowl. They do a drawing with business cards and he used to like take the business cards and that's how he got sales leads.
Yeah. Oh my God. That
they totally modernized, you know, the Rolodex.
We had a competition at Shift Communications to try to get the most connections. And I remember I was the first person to get to 500. I was like, yes, I have 500 movers and shakers I'm connected to in Silicon Valley, baby. And now I can't take any more connections because 35,000 is the limit. And I maxed out like five.
That's amazing.
Years.
That's amazing. What are you going to do if you find someone really good that wants to connect with you? Are you going to?
I will delete people who are kind of dead weight in my feed. I go through and prune that every now and then.
I haven't hit mine yet.
I haven't hit mine either. But it's good to know, Becca. We know that we're going to be cut off.
Yeah, 35. You can, and you know what's so annoying about that? Just to go off on a little tangent, is like every time someone sends me a connection request and I'm maxed out, I have to be like, I'm sorry, I cannot accept your connection request. Unfortunately, LinkedIn limits me to 35. Can't they just automatically do that so I don't have to do that? Or worse, ignore the people, that's worse. Why am I in that situation? You cut me off. Can you please explain for me?
You know what? Touché. Becca has some contacts at LinkedIn. I think
we I have a theory. LinkedIn hates its users. That's why, Perry. This is my theory. And if you ask me or any of the content creators on LinkedIn, we've got like side chats going where we all come and gripe about X, Y, or Z. And the conclusion we always come to is LinkedIn hates its content creators. So here we are.
I don't defend LinkedIn. I don't think that's true, but.
Well, they are monetizing not content creators. They are paying non-LinkedIn users to come to LinkedIn and use LinkedIn. Why not pay your content creators who have been here for years?
Now, so I fully agree with that. And I know this is a little far afield from what we were talking about initially, but I will say, though they do not do transactional stuff by paying people like me, I will say that I've enjoyed millions and millions and millions of dollars of revenue derived from my presence on this platform. So is it direct? No, but
absolutely.
But man, what a correlation.
Absolutely.
I got some sweet brand sponsorships that are not worth millions of dollars in revenue.
We'll pay you $40 per post.
No, my floor price now, I've become very a stickler on it. I'm like, look, if LinkedIn's not going to pay me, you are. So, yeah. All right. Now that we're getting close to time, we have to go to our rapid fire questions, Brooke, which are my favorite part of the show, because we ask the same questions to everybody, but we're doing a different format than we used to. So I'm going to ask you the same questions I ask everybody. And then Perry is going to come in with a new unhinged.
Great.
We all have to answer a question that I don't even know what the question is. Great. So I'm excited to hear it, but we're going to start with the easy ones. So Brooke, you get to erase one corporate buzzword from existence. What is it?
Oh my God. That's such a good question. Let's circle back.
Ooh, nice. Okay, well, let's circle back on that one. Yeah. You're about to give a presentation in front of 50,000 people, like stadium style. What song do you walk to the stage on?
God, let's see. I would probably do the Killer song, Mr. Brightside.
Nice.
Yep.
All right. You're Mr. Brightside.
Mrs. Brightside.
You're Mrs. Brightside. If you had to do a TED Talk, Mrs. Brightside, on anything but recruiting, marketing, communications, whatever, what would your topic be?
I would talk about how to raise resilient children, because I think that is so important. And I think that, how to not helicopter parent and how to give children the right values.
I love it.
I mean, I would have to do a lot of research to do that.
I was going
to
say, I mean, are you already an expert? Can you give us
I'm not at all. But I want to have resilient children. So
yeah. I love it. All right. And this fun, my final question, you get to only use one emoji for the rest of your life. Which one?
I mean, I would probably do, I would do the one where the head is like cracking like an egg and it's like melting.
Oh, the melty face. Yeah, me too. Melty face, number one.
Yeah.
We all love the melty.
I think a lot of us are using that far too often these days, but for
because it's like, it can mean so much. It can be good day, bad day.
Yeah, I'm tired. I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed. I hate this. I hate my life. Anyway, carry on. Perry, time for some unhinged madness.
All right. Brand new question I cooked up today. All right. A lot of these have to do with cash. Like, what would you do for cash, basically? So, Brooke, you are given an opportunity to pocket $20 million free and clear, interest-free, tax-free, today. $20 million. Okay. That's walking, that's riding off into the sunset money. All you have to do in exchange for that is take one bunny rabbit and throw it into a wood chipper. Do you throw the bunny into the wood chipper and take the $20 million?
I would never kill an animal or hurt an animal.
One bunny into the wood chipper. It's over instantly.
I don't think I could do it.
Okay. No. You're saying no? $20 million. I'm taking this $20 million right back. You have a few more seconds. You take
it. What about $100 million?
I don't like violence.
I'm not asking you to like violence. I'm asking you, would you pay $20 million?
I honestly don't think I would, because I would have to live with myself every day of hurting an animal. And that's not the right way to make money.
Now, how about a frog?
I mean, again, I don't like these questions. I don't want to hurt animals or people. I promote kindness.
What about a frog? $20 million, one frog.
I cannot see myself like literally intentionally killing a human or an animal in any way. So
okay, what about a spider? Last one.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean spiders. I would take them back. This is it. These are really strange questions. Where did unhinged. You go, Perry? It's really unhinged.
I just thought of it.
The reason I'm going back on that is because when I see a spider, I take a piece of a Kleenex and then I flush it. You know.
I just scream and then somebody comes and kills it for me.
I tell you the other one I thought of today that I think is less sort of insane. Would you take $20 million, Brooke, except every time you laugh from now on, you laugh exactly like a donkey, as loud as a donkey?
I'm totally fine.
That's funny.
Oh my gosh, she is so rich. She just has this weird laugh.
Yeah, but look at her jewelry. Look at her clothes.
Oh my god, she's been on an amazing.
Who's the donkey now?
Look at all our homes.
What about you, Perry? Would you kill a bunny?
I think I would. I'm sorry to say. For $20 million, I think I would. And I say that because I've shot like animals, like a groundhog in my yard. I think I would do it. I'd be very unhappy, very sad with myself. I would not like anything about it, but I would like all the things I could do with $20 million.
But like, here's the thing. A lot of people like bunnies are a nuisance. Like kill it. Like my neighbor just told me that he traps squirrels and takes them off and drops them like 30 miles away because he doesn't want to kill them. But like in the county I live in, if you trap a squirrel, you have to kill it. That's the rule.
I live in southern New Hampshire. All of my neighbors, for real, are killing squirrels, bunnies, chipmunks.
Yeah, really dark. You guys said this podcast was called Under Embargo, not talking about killing animals.
I warned you that it was unhinged. That's all Perry.
What did you sign up for?
Note for the future. No murder questions, Perry.
Yes. But then it's going to be like, would you rather
Well, Mark, we have time to give you one of the original ones, which was, would you rather have hiccups for, what was the question? Would you rather have hiccups for 6 months, 6 months or chop off your own pinky?
I would have hiccups for 6 months.
Guess what Becca would do?
Speaking of you said chopping off my own.
No, she would have hiccups. Oh wait, I would not have hiccups.
Yeah, Becca would chop off her finger.
I would chop off my finger.
I watched a show last night, a new Netflix show, and they had that was a punishment.
Someone What's the show?
It's called Under Embargo. No, it's called Black Rabbit. It's with Jason Bateman.
Oh right, is it good? I heard it's good.
It's good. It's
Black Rabbit.
It's really great to watch right before bed if you're like a comms pro or recruiter and you just want to take a load off. You're like at the edge of your seat. So it's very
That's intense. How I unwind every night with a little anxiety inducing
true crime.
Well, you need to, right? It's the only way you can like normalize.
Yes.
So to recap for our listeners at home, Brooke would throw a rabbit into a wood chipper. Thank you.
Good night, everybody. I would not do that.
And she loves murder shows before bed. Thank you for coming to the show.
I do like true crime. I don't know what that says about me.
I do too. I think it says you're normal. My kid asked me one day in the car because we listened to like podcasts. He's like, Mom, if I like murder shows, does that mean I'm going to be a murderer? And I was like, it does not, because I love murder shows and I would not kill a bunny. So there you go.
I was just going to say, Perry, do you like true crime?
You mean the show?
Oh, just true crime shows.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay, because you would kill a bunny, so we're just trying to figure out the profile.
I mean, reluctantly, but yes.
I mean, yeah, he's not going to celebrate it. The wood chipper part really makes it
viable. Well, it's instantaneous. That's the thing that's good about it. I mean, there's nothing good about it, honestly. It's terrible.
All right. Well, Brooke, I'm going to give you an opportunity to share anything you would like with our listeners or with us or whatever. Is there anything that you would like to share?
I mean, I could share a lot of things. One, I don't kill animals. But I think what I would want to share is that it has been a really frustrating job market for comms people for quite some time. And I can see that and I hear that. And I do believe it's getting better. And I do believe more opportunities are being created. And I do believe we are on an upward swing. I'm very direct, but I'm also optimistic. And I do think things are getting better.
I love the optimism. How can people find you, Brooke?
A great way to find me, Becca, is on LinkedIn under Brooke Kruger. And then you can also learn more about my company, KC Partners, on my website, which is www.kc-partners.com.
And I'll give you the endorsement that Brooke knows everybody, because anytime I ask anyone if they know Brooke, they're like, yeah, obviously I know Brooke. So there you go. If you're in the comms world, get on Brooke's radar.
Yes.
Perry, any final thoughts?
I'm just really disappointed in Brooke's choice to kill rabbits. That's it.
That's going to be like, what's quote? That's going to be like,
no, we promise that won't be the clip, Brooke. We out of
context.
Brooke Kruger, recruiter, kills bunnies, bunny killer. BK, bunny killer.
Brooke Kruger or Freddy Kruger? Am I right?
Sorry, Brooke. We really brought your crazy level to a whole new one today.
This is good. You guys got me out of my head for the past hour, so I love it.
We had a blast. It was great. It really was fascinating to hear about what your world is like and how it relates to ours. It's really a fascinating time.
Yes.
Thank you for coming, Brooke.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.